Thank you. will come to order.
Okay, good morning again. We'll move on to the second case of the morning, which is Volker versus Porsche. Mr. Hall.
May it please the court. My name is R.J. Hall, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this matter. Your Honor, I would like to touch on one issue briefly. It relates to jurisdiction. And on August 6, 2003, this court entered an order into a very in a case very similar to this one, which relates to the Magnuson-Moss Act. It was the case of Diamond versus Porsche. I don't know if the court is concerned about the jurisdiction with respect to that order.
I am.
Yeah, very concerned.
I will address that. That's exactly why I wanted to do that right off the bat, Your Honor. The difference between the Diamond and the Porsche case in this matter before this court is, although both cases were removed from state court, in the underlying Diamond case, there was a Supreme Court Rule 222 disclosure, which stated that the damages being sought were less than $50,000. Here, Your Honors, as alleged in the complaint, the damages are in excess of $50,000. So on the complaint, especially taken with the motion to dismiss, it must be taken as true as pled. So therefore, that distinguishes this case from the Diamond matter.
How can it be more than $50,000?
Yeah, because I don't think you have enough factual information to substantiate that. Just the bare allegation of compensatory damages in the sum of at least $50,000 is not enough.
May I address that?
Yes.
Your Honor, the facts in this matter here is that Mr. Volker purchased this car in June of 2001. Under the terms of the lease, it would have totaled in excess of $100,000. Here he had the car for 2 years. If he is forced to pay on the contract, which he has since received a bill, which is not a part of the record because it was after the fact, he would be damaged in excess of $100,000, because as our position is that this car is worthless as it is in its condition with respect to the side airbags. Your Honor, Porsche represented to Mr. Volker that the side airbags were important and were a part of its safety features. They were active. Not only is this a part of the Porsche website, this is also a part of representations made to him by the dealership, Champion Motors. So, Your Honor, the fact of the matter is that the damages arise out of the fact that this car is essentially worthless. So if Mr. Volker is forced to pay on it, he's going to have to pay perhaps $100,000 or more. But, Your Honor, if I might move on. The crux of this case relates to the issue of...
Of course, we have to, in order to get to that, your reasoning on the jurisdictional amount, we have to buy into your theory about the side airbag issue, that it's totally unusable right now. I mean, that's the only way you can make that, because you agree that he suffered $25,000 in damage when the car, you know, the car was in the accident, and pretty much most of that has been repaired. And so, I mean, we have to buy into your theory in order to reach the jurisdictional amount that it's worthless with the side airbags where they are now.
I would agree with you. I mean, that is definitely a minimum threshold requirement that we have to cross this morning. But I believe, with respect to as it is pled, and this is a motion to dismiss, Your Honors, this is not a summary judgment. It is on the face of the pleadings, and it's pled, and it's in excess of $50,000. So I believe that does get us past the threshold argument.
But the district court never looked into that amount, other than just a mere allegation.
I understand that, Your Honor, I completely agree with you. They did not look into that issue, neither side brought it up. It was removed to federal court, and the lower court took jurisdiction over the matter. And I believe this court properly has jurisdiction on this matter, on the amount of damages.
That's sort of an odd situation here. You file a case in state court.
Correct.
That's where you want to litigate. The defense moves at the federal court, and now it says we don't have enough damages for federal jurisdiction, so it goes back to state court. That's where you wanted to be in the first place. Why are you here?
Well, Your Honor, frankly, we would like this addressed. I think there are some very important issues that need to be addressed. There is currently a split in the Northern District as to the application, for example, of the Magnuson-Moss Act, and I think it's very important that this issue be decided. That is why we're here today. This would delay, if we were sent back to state court, it would delay the matter further. Essentially, we'd be starting from scratch because, as you did in the Diamond case, the order was vacated. The lower court's order was vacated, and it was sent back to the state court. So we'd be back at square one.
Under Magnus and Moss, at least, we have jurisdiction.
Absolutely, and there's also actually two other issues as well. There's the Truth in Lending Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which also gives us court jurisdiction.
Of course, the Magnus and Moss Act has a $50,000 requirement for jurisdiction.
That is correct. And along with, but with respect to the Truth in the TILA Act, Truth in Lending Act, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, I believe it is properly before this court, and this court should decide it on its merits. Again, Your Honor, the focus here is the consumer protection.
I might be wrong. I thought only the Magnus and Moss claims were the ones you were complaining about.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
It's the only remaining claim left, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, what I was referring to was essentially jurisdiction back to the district court with the three federal claims at issue.
Well, maybe I'm missing something. You're
precise.
Well, I thought the only federal claim.
Money. You don't have enough money to make
I thought the only federal claim you're concerned with is the Magnus and Moss warranty claim, and if you lose that, you're going back to state court.
That would be correct if we lose it on appeal. But again, I guess the issue it comes down to is whether or not this court has jurisdiction over this case.
So what do we care about this Truth in Lending claims and all that?
What I was essentially trying to explain to the court was that that is how the district court also garnered jurisdiction over on the lower court level.
But those claims have all been dismissed, and you've appealed only the Magnus and Moss claim.
That is correct.
So these other claims that you're talking about are not part of this case anymore if the Magnus and Moss issue is resolved unfavorably to you.
I agree with you that the Truth in Lending and the Fair Credit Reporting Act are not a part of the appeal. So the federal issue before this court right now is the Magnus and Moss Act.
But you can't bootstrap on those dismissed claims to get jurisdiction. Essentially, that's what you were kind of implying, that we could look back on those and that would help you from a jurisdictional standpoint. They're dead in the water.
I'm sorry. No, that wasn't my point, Your Honor, and I apologize if I implied that at all. What I was essentially trying to do was explain how obviously I was not clear enough, was that's how the lower court got jurisdiction originally. You are 100% correct that the only issue before this court, as far as the federal act goes, is the Magnus and Moss Act. And again, I implore upon this court that the fact is on the pleadings, it is pled in excess of $50,000. With respect to the Consumer Protection Act, Your Honor, there's really three at issue. We've already touched upon the Magnus and Moss Act, but there's also the UCC and the Lemon Law, for lack of a better term. All three of those statutes, and I'll focus on the last two first, are consumer protection-oriented statutes. What Porsche is essentially, PCNA, Porsche Cars of North America, is essentially trying to do is say, we provided you a written limited warranty, and the express warranty or the Lemon Law does not apply to you. And Your Honor, we submit that is just simply not correct. What Porsche PCNA provided to Mr. Fred, to the plaintiff appellant, were certain express warranties. Not only was it the written warranty that what they coined as the limited warranty, it was also certain representations made to Mr. Velker before he purchased the vehicle about the safety of the vehicle. Your Honors, one of the key, as pled, one of the key focuses of entering into this, leasing this vehicle, was the operability of these side airbags. Mr. Velker was struck by a 5,000-pound SUV going in excess of 25 miles an hour. And as the district court says, it talks about the car passing over the Porsche. Although the Porsche is low, it did not pass over the Porsche. It hit it square on the side. It hit Mr. Velker right here. So, and the airbags did not go off. Now,
that just doesn't seem like the kind of a claim that really fits under Magnus and Moss. You know, they sell you a Porsche and it's got a Chevrolet engine or something in it. They warrant that it's a Porsche engine, that's a Porsche engine, that's why you're paying all this money. That seems like the type of case that Magnuson Moss is concerned about, and why they're giving federal courts jurisdiction over those cases. Now, this other stuff is all, seems like all state personal injury lawsuits.
With respect to that, I don't believe that the Magnuson Moss was geared towards or was intended to distinguish between different severity levels of malfunctions or incompatibilities or something along those lines.
What about defective design?
I believe that is a part of the Magnuson Moss Act, but I don't believe we have that here. This is a defective product case, a warranty case, from the standpoint that what Porsche will not do is abide by what they promised. Here the airbags don't go off. This isn't our admission, this isn't our investigation, this isn't an expert's investigation. This is PCNA's own person admitting this, actually two of them. And what they say is the sensor is actually low in the car, and in the type of accident where this SUV strikes a car in this area, it's not going to go off. And as this court is well aware, and as we plead in the complaint, there are many of the cars out there SUVs. So how can a person sit in a car, and a consumer, and not be afforded the protections of the Magnuson Moss Act, where that's what it's intended to do? It's clear, I mean, in all the cases I've read, the intent is to provide protection to consumers. This isn't limited to, Magnuson Moss isn't limited to a Volkswagen in a Porsche or something.
Yeah, but this isn't really a personal injury case, is it?
No.
You're claiming that the car... Then you had problems with the leasing company and the car, whether it was going to be fixed and how long it was going to take and all those sorts of things. I just don't know how that gets shoehorned, that all those kind of claims and the damages you're seeking into a Magnuson Moss Act claim.
Perhaps I'm misunderstanding, but the Magnuson Moss is a consumer protection act that is geared towards obviously protecting consumers. This is... falls, I think, squarely within the Magnuson Moss Act. Here, you have airbags that don't deploy. It's just not in Mr. Velker's vehicle. Porsche PCNA did not come back and say, well, it was just in your car. They say in the design of the Porsche. So this is not just an isolated incident, in our opinion. This is pretty serious. And if consumers are not allowed or afforded the protections of not only Magnuson Moss, it obviates the intent of Congress.
So what about the issue of the lease versus ownership as far as the consumer definition of consumer?
With respect to the Magnuson Moss Act?
Yes.
That is actually a very interesting issue. Again, I think the issue comes back to whether or not the act would be intended to protect consumers. I don't believe Congress intended to differentiate between lessees and purchasers. That would essentially put classes of consumers in two different classes. You've got the lessees and you've got the consumers, when the overall intent of the statute is to provide protection to consumers in general, regardless of the, no pun intended, the vehicle used to get to that point.
Well, there are two analyses. And one is the New York case, the Court of Appeals in New York, whatever it was, and then I forget what state the other one is in, where they... One takes your position, one takes the other position, and I assume you agree with the analysis of what's the name of that case?
There's the DeCento one is from New York, and the one in the Northern District is, I believe it is Cohen versus AM General, and then the other one is Henderson out of Pennsylvania. And, Your Honors, there's actually another one, but I will not get into it. But, again, I think that what we go into here is what is the intent of Congress. The intent was not to distinguish between lessees and lessors. The Cohen case and the Henderson case, I apologize, says that lessees were intended to be protected by the Magnuson Moss Act. So, therefore, it makes no sense that these acts wouldn't apply to them. I have a little less than a minute left, but
okay.
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. McKinney.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. Obviously, with jurisdiction having been raised, I will open my remarks on the head issue. I don't think jurisdiction is a problem or a concern or an issue here. I think jurisdiction is firmly established. Jurisdiction attaches at the time, in this instance, the notice of removal is filed. When the notice of removal was filed in the district court, in addition to the Magnuson-Moss Act claim, there were claims brought under the Truth in Lending Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Under both of those statutes, the district court had original jurisdiction over the claims asserted under those statutes. Under Section 1367, Title 28 U.S.C., the court has supplemental jurisdiction over any and all other claims brought in conjunction with the federal claims that it has original jurisdiction over. So jurisdiction was established at the time of removal. That's what's operative. That's the operative point in time. Any subsequent change in the pleadings does not divest the court of jurisdiction. The fact that the TILA and Fair Credit Reporting Act claims were dismissed and not appealed does not divest the federal courts of jurisdiction. Once jurisdiction is established, it exists and it continues throughout the termination of the case, regardless of what happens. Under 1367, however, the court, I think, does have discretion where it does dismiss all federal claims to then defer jurisdiction or to then remand. But it's discretionary. It's not mandatory. This court was not, or the federal court, the federal system was not divested of jurisdiction by virtue of dismissal of the TILA and Fair Credit Reporting Act claims.
This is odd. So what you're saying is that if your opponent wins this case, you're conceding that they properly alleged $50,000 or more in damages attributable to a Magnuson-Moss warranty claim.
No, I'm not conceding that, nor need I concede that for federal jurisdiction to be appropriate in this case. Federal jurisdiction was based, premised on the TILA and Fair Credit Reporting Act. The district court has original jurisdiction, statutory grant of jurisdiction, under those statutes.
And that's just what you said, but do you think they met the $50,000 jurisdictional amount on this particular claim?
I think under...
Do you think they fell short? Do you think they fell short of the $50,000 on this particular count that's left?
Among within the relief requested under the Magnuson-Moss Act, I think was essentially a claim for rescission and revocation. That was directed against, among others, Porsche Cars North America. I think if we were to hold Porsche Cars liable for the full amount, for the full amount of the residual value on the vehicle, any amounts paid under the loan, that would certainly total more than $50,000 that they would be liable for. And then the question is, where does the vehicle go back to? Because Porsche wouldn't be entitled to it. Porsche Cars North America, they're not the lessor or the owner of the vehicle. That's Porsche Leasing Limited or Porsche Finance. You have different entities. I did not and have not at this point, because of the allegations of the complaint, gone and done a Gardinsky-Leshek analysis, and it simply wasn't an issue in the district court. I also think that to the extent, to find the Gardinsky-Leshek analysis extremely difficult to comprehend and apply, it seems on its face a fairly simple formula. You take the purchase price of the vehicle minus the value of the vehicle return minus the use made of the vehicle, but there's no numbers plugged into that equation in the Gardinsky-Leshek case because the price of the vehicle is only $18,000 at the outset. It didn't matter. You were never going to get to $50,000 there. But how the court expects or how the court intends for that test to be applied, certainly I think the bar could use guidance on that if that becomes an issue in your analysis here. For the reason stated before, I really don't think it should be. I think jurisdiction, because with 1367, supplemental jurisdiction, it does not matter whether $50,000 is in controversy under Magnuson-Moss or not. The district court still had jurisdiction because it had original jurisdiction over the TILA and Fair Credit Reporting Act claims.
So then to summarize, you don't want to assert the jurisdictional defense on $50,000, so you join Mr. Hall on that. And you're going to rest your appeal here on the claim that this is a lease, Magnuson-Moss doesn't apply to lease has to be a sale. So if you lose on that, you go back to the district court.
I don't think that in good faith I can argue that jurisdiction is lacking here based on the prior decisions of this court and the Supreme Court on the jurisdictional issue of when it attaches and what happens going forward. I don't think I can make that argument in good faith.
You think it's discretionary then? For instance, once there is jurisdiction, the court had pendent jurisdiction over the state claims, which the court decided not to rule on. Whatever it is, sent back to the state court, the ones he didn't rule on. But he could have kept all those, and are you saying on the same basis he could keep Magnus and Moss, even though there's no original jurisdiction, he would have pendant jurisdiction?
Well, I especially yes, and what I'm saying is, and we've kind of gone away statutorily from the term pendant and ancillary jurisdiction to this concept of supplemental jurisdiction, where we view the case as a whole and we look at the claims asserted, and if there's original jurisdiction over one claim asserted, the court has supplemental jurisdiction over all other claims asserted. And why is that provision?
Well, he did rule on some of the state claims, obviously.
He did. Yeah. He did. On those that were part of the motion, those that were not raised or addressed in the motion to dismiss, the judge remanded without ruling on it. I don't think federal courts should chop cases in half. I think they should exercise their supplemental jurisdiction, and I think
they should or shouldn't. I'm just wondering if that's where this falls under that. I don't know the answer, frankly.
That's not a question that I looked at in terms of preparation today, feeling that jurisdiction was firmly established. And so far as the Magnuson-Moss Act is concerned, it is a statute that is designed to give consumers more information when they go out and purchase vehicles and to fill some of the interstices in UCC sales law that Congress felt would be beneficial to the consumer, particularly in the area of attorney fees. They've encouraged lawyers now to represent consumers in warranty cases because they generally are very low award type cases. If I have a problem with my transmission and you don't fix it, and I ultimately have to spend $3,000 to get it replaced, that would be my recovery to get my $3,000 back. It is economically unfeasible for most private attorneys to take on a $3,000 case. It will cost more than that to obtain recovery, to simply work up the file. So that's why the Magnuson-Moss Act is there. It is not some overarching consumer protection statute designed to remedy any conceivable ill that may arise in the context of a consumer transaction. It's very limited, and it's limited to warranties. In fact, if you look at the as Krasinski Leszczyk described it, the unusual jurisdictional clause, it says a consumer damaged by failure to comply with obligations under a written warranty, implied warranty, or service contract may bring an act. And that's the key to what we're talking about today, these definitions. What is a written warranty? The Act says it's a warranty given in the connection with the sale of a product. Similarly, the Act defines implied warranty as implied warranty arising under state law in connection with the sale of a product. Clearly, the Act speaks in terms of sale. Does the Act mean what it says, that the Magnuson-Moss Act is limited to sales? The legislative history, I think the language, we need go no further, because the language is quite clear. But in DeSantio and some of the other cases, the courts have gone and looked beyond the clear statutory language and gone to the legislative history, where they found, one, is that in prior versions of the bill, initial versions, during Senate hearings, House hearings, there was debate, there was testimony heard, critical of the statute that it did not specifically make reference to and incorporate lessees within its coverage. That was a criticism, yet the bill did not include it. If we, again, go to legislative history and compare that to TILA, when it was initially enacted, did not specifically provide for the inclusion of consumer leases. However, in 1976, remember, Magnuson-Moss became effective in 1976, Congress went back to TILA, noted that consumer leasing is on the rise, on the increase, and we're going to include consumer leasing under TILA's provisions. It did not go back, did not alter, did not change the Magnuson-Moss Act to go and include lessees. This, DeSantio concluded, is evidence of a conscious policy decision made by Congress that lessees are not in need of and will not be protected under the Magnuson-Moss Act. Instead, we will limit the coverage to owners and buyers. And consistent with that, the courts in finding and holding that the Magnuson-Moss Act indeed does not apply to consumer products obtained under a lease have focused on the different rights, the different bundles of rights, the different risks that are involved to owners versus lessees. And an owner has a different risk because the lessee can always walk away from the consumer product if there are problems, where an owner can't. If you look at the language, if you look at the statutory history, if you look at the policies underlying the statute, I think it becomes very clear that indeed Congress meant what it said, that the Magnuson-Moss Act only applies where there is a sale and does not apply in conjunction with a lease. Another issue that arises here under the Magnuson-Moss Act is the concept of privity. Illinois and the federal courts in this district and throughout the country, there's a split as to whether or not privity is required under the Magnuson-Moss Act to give rise to a claim for an implied warranty. Now, the Magnuson-Moss Act, as we discussed, says that an implied warranty is one arising under state law. The federal courts that have looked at it, except for the Cohen decision in this district, and several other decisions out of this district, as well as the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, have said that arising under state law means state law determines whether or not privity is required to give rise to the implied warranty of merchantability. In fact, the Soldinger case versus Aston Martin Lagonda, I think, is a very good analysis of the privity issue, and it also points out the flaw in the Illinois court's reasoning. The Illinois Supreme Court, at around the same time, the Second Circuit said that you look to state law, and if state law requires privity, then there is none, then the implied warranty doesn't arise. The Illinois Supreme Court looked at the same question and said, well, Magnuson-Moss doesn't really say this, but we think given the overarching consumer protection concerns and giving that it says that you can't modify or disclaim an implied warranty if you enter into some other service contract or other agreement within 90 days of sale, we think that Congress meant to impose implied warranties where state law would not. Well, one, that's inconsistent with the language. It's inconsistent with what the federal courts have held. This, too, is an issue that, quite frankly, needs to be addressed by a court of review. The law needs to be made certain here because we have this split, and it would seem this being a federal statute, it's appropriate that a federal court address the issue and resolve it, particularly here in Illinois. Moving on to a couple of the other issues, plaintiff talks about the UCC, whether or not this is a UCC warranty, and the Illinois Lemon Law describes those two statutes as consumer protection statutes as well. Obviously, the UCC is not a consumer protection statute. Rather, of course, it is the law governing commercial sales. If we look again at the language of the statute, we find that it is quite clear as to what constitutes an express warranty, an affirmation of fact, a promise about the quality or performance of the goods. And what we have here is, in the written warranty, is a promise of what the warranty will do if there's a defect in materials or workmanship. In plaintiff's complaint, they make it very clear that what we're talking about, the warranty that we contend is an express warranty under the Magnuson-Moss Act, is this written limited warranty from PCNA. However, in their papers down below and now in their papers and argument here, they say, well, that's really not the warranty we were going after. We think that some statements on a website, well, that may cover it as well, and that will may make it in. Well, one, if we look at these statements on the website, they certainly don't qualify. Two, but more importantly, if we look at the complaint itself, we see that plaintiff is specifically relying on and making reference to the limited warranty here. And if, in fact, this written warranty from PCNA was an express warranty under the UCC, why then would the Magnuson-Moss Act, Congress, have gone out of its way to give a special definition of written warranties to make perfectly clear that warranties like the PCNA warranty would qualify for protection when given in connection with the sale of a consumer product? So, again, that's why Magnuson-Moss is there to clarify, to assist. It should be applied consistent with its provisions. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You got about a minute, I believe. All right.
Okay. It's only a minute you have to be brief.
I will, I promise. Your Honor, with respect to the issue of privity, in the decision, in the, I believe, the Hasek decision, where the, excuse me, the Cosman's Hasek decision, excuse me, the court rejected the privity argument. They said that no privity was required. That was in the Northern District of Illinois. With respect to the application of the written warranty of UCC in the Lemon Law, essentially, if PCNA's argument is adopted, you will have manufacturers creating limited, quote-unquote, limited warranties which obviate the protections of the statute. They will draft language in their warranties which exclude the UCC and completely exclude the Lemon Law. That clearly is not the purpose and the intent of the statute. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. The case will be taken under advisement.